Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories, along with Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
People flying into India's southern city of Cochin may see numerous solar panels around Cochin International Airport. But they may not know that the airport was the first in the world to be fully powered by solar energy. A sea of shiny solar panels stretches across land running next to the airport's main road. Many more panels sit on top of a massive parking structure. All are capturing valuable sunlight that is changed to energy to power all airport operations. The project began 5 years ago when airport officials were looking for new ways to reduce ever-increasing electricity bills. The airport's director, Vijay Kurian, says they came up with the solar idea and decided to begin with a small experiment. We put solar panels on the rooftop of Terminal 1. We observed it for a year, and we found it is quite good and can be safely scaled up, Kurian told VOA. This success led to further expansion of solar operations at the airport. In 2015, Cochin officials declared that the airport had become the world's first to be fully powered by solar energy. Today, tens of thousands of solar panels produce more than enough power to keep the airport running 24 hours a day. Airport officials say any leftover energy the airport does not need is stored in the city's general energy grid. Kurian says in the beginning, there were concerns about whether the new system made financial sense. At the time, the cost of producing 1 megawatt of power was estimated to cost $1 million. But the falling price of solar panels in recent years greatly lowered the costs and helped make the project a reality. We get back our investment in less than 6 years' time, Kurian said, which I thought was an excellent investment opportunity, and the next 25 years is meant for all profit. Last year, the airport won one of the United Nations' top environmental honors, the Champions of the Earth Award for Entrepreneurial Vision. The project is one example of recent efforts by officials in India to increase the use of solar power to reduce its carbon emissions. The solar expansion at Cochin has led additional airports and other kinds of building projects to explore the possible use of solar energy. To keep its standing as the world's only fully solar-powered airport, the facility has continually expanded its energy operations. Officials say the current production level of about 29 megawatts will soon grow to nearly 40 megawatts. The increase will be necessary to keep up with ever-growing passenger traffic. Airport officials have estimated the amount of carbon emissions to be reduced over the next 25 years would be equal to planting about 3 million trees. And to make the project even greener, vegetables are being grown under the solar panels and on other available land. Last year, about 60 tons of vegetables were produced and sold. I'm Brian Lynn.
At least one-third of the ice in the Himalayan mountains will disappear by the end of this century because of rising temperatures, scientists said this week. This will threaten river flows that provide water resources for 1.9 billion people. Huge glaciers make the Hindu Kush Himalaya area, the planet's so-called third pole, behind Antarctica and the Arctic. The area is home to the world's highest mountains. It stretches 3,500 kilometers across Nepal, Bangladesh, Bhutan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, China, India, and Myanmar. The Hindu Kush Himalayan assessment was released on Monday. The Nepal-based International Center for Integrated Mountain Development, or ICIMOD, carried out the five-year report. It is one of the largest ever studies on warming in mountain areas. More than 200 experts helped write the report. "This is the climate crisis you haven't heard of," said Philippus Wester, who led the report. Wester said climate change is set to turn cold, ice-covered Himalayan mountains to bare rocks by the year 2100. Himalayan glaciers feed 10 major rivers, including the Yangtze, Ganges, and the Indus. Farmers living in the area use glacial meltwater for their crops in the dry season. About 250 million people live in the mountains. Another 1.65 billion people live in river valleys below. Changes in river flows could also harm hydropower production and cause more landslides in the mountains. Along with global warming, air pollution is also affecting the area, the study found. The Hindu Kush includes an area called the Indo-Gangetic Plains, one of the most polluted places in the world. Air pollutants like black carbon and dust land on the glaciers, which speeds up their melting, too. The report said that one-third of the ice will melt by 2100, even if governments worldwide meet goals set by the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement to limit global warming. But if governments fail to limit greenhouse gas emissions, about two-thirds of ice in the Himalayas could disappear by 2100. Wester told the Reuters news agency, "To me, this is the biggest worrying thing." The study said governments in the region must change their existing agriculture systems, prepare for droughts, and put up early flood warning systems. The report's writers noted that people living in small island states are often considered the most vulnerable to climate change because of rising sea levels. But Dasho Rinzen Dorji, who is with EC Mode, said mountain areas such as the Himalayas are also extremely vulnerable climate hotspots. It's not just occupants of the world's islands that are suffering, he said. David Molden is director of EC Mode. He added, mountain people are really getting hit hard. We have to do something now.
Chloe Kim was one of America's top Olympians during last year's Winter Games in Pyeongchang, South Korea. The snowboarding champion, who grew up in California, competed there at 17 years of age. She became the youngest woman ever to win an Olympic gold medal in the halfpipe competition. Kim clearly feels at home on the mountain and inside the halfpipe. She recently won a halfpipe competition during the Winter X Games in Aspen, Colorado. And she is a big favorite in an upcoming World Championship competition in Utah. But the 18-year-old snowboarder has decided to trade some trips down the halfpipe for an Ivy League education. Beginning next fall, Kim will be joining Princeton University's class of 2023. Instead of centering on the physics of her winning snowboard moves, she could now be learning the subject in school. And in addition to making her own history, she will now be studying it. In a recent interview with the Associated Press, Kim said her aim is to make her higher education experience as normal as possible. I'd love to be Chloe, the girl who sits next to me in English class, Kim said. My life has always been so different. I'd love to live a normal life for once. But she admits that could be a tricky goal. Her snowboarding career has made her highly recognizable. Kim received widespread attention during the Pyeongchang Games. The publicity was fueled by her friendly, energetic nature as well as her interesting family story. Her parents are from South Korea. One of her most memorable Olympic runs began with Kim giving a quick shout-out to her South Korean grandmother. This one's for you, Grams, she said. It was her grandmother's first time watching Kim perform in person. On that day, Kim dropped into the halfpipe and landed back-to-back 1,080-degree turns on her second and third jumps. That combination had never been successfully completed by any other woman in competition. Along her path to Olympic gold, Kim also became a social media star. She often tweeted about the things she loves to do and eat. In one message, she told her followers two of her favorite foods, churros and ice cream. Since then, many fans and some companies have sent churros and ice cream right to her door. Since attending the Pyeongchang Games, Kim has had the chance to do some other cool things off the mountain. She helped design a snowboarding Barbie doll in her likeness. She rapped with hip-hop artist G-Eazy and joined other sports stars to be honored with ESPY Awards. While all of this was fun, Kim says she now looks forward to a new challenge, earning a degree from one of America's top universities. She says she considers her acceptance to Princeton just as much an honor as earning an Olympic gold medal. It's really crazy because Princeton was my dream school before snowboarding took off, Kim told the AP. I just liked the name when I was really young and didn't know about college or anything. My parents were like, okay, whatever. When it really happened, it's like, oh, okay. It's just really exciting. She is still deciding what her exact field of study will be at Princeton. But she said it will involve something science-related, possibly chemistry or biology. And she does not plan to put her snowboard away anytime soon. She is attempting to work out a plan that will permit her to keep training while going to classes. Kim says her sports and educational goals go hand in hand. It's all about progressing the sport and also pushing myself, she said, to see what I can do and how far I can go.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Just before sunrise on April 12, 1861, the first shot was fired in the American Civil War. A heavy mortar roared, sending a shell high over the harbor at Charleston, South Carolina. The shell dropped and exploded above Fort Sumter, a United States military base on an island in the harbor. The explosion was a signal for all Confederate guns surrounding the fort to open fire. Shell after shell smashed into the fort. The booming of the cannons woke the people of Charleston. They rushed to the harbor and cheered as the bursting shells lighted the dark sky. Jack Moyles and Stuart Spencer tell about the attack on Fort Sumter.
Confederate leaders ordered the attack after President Abraham Lincoln refused to withdraw the small force of American soldiers at Sumter. Food supplies at the fort were very low, and Southerners expected hunger would force the soldiers to leave. But Lincoln announced he was sending a ship to Fort Sumter with food. Confederate President Jefferson Davis ordered his commander in Charleston, General Beauregard, to destroy the fort before the food could arrive.
The attack started from Fort Johnson, across the harbor from Sumter. A Virginia congressman, Roger Pryor, was visiting Fort Johnson when the order to fire was given. The fort's commander asked Pryor if he would like the honor of firing the mortar that would begin the attack. No, answered Pryor, and his voice shook. I cannot fire the first gun of the war. But others could, and the attack began.
At Fort Sumter, Major Robert Anderson and his men waited 3 hours before firing back at the Confederate guns. Anderson could not use his most powerful cannons. They were in the open, at the top of the fort, where there was no protection for the gunners. Too many of his small force would be lost if he tried to fire these guns. So Anderson had his men fire the smaller cannon from better protected positions. These, however, did not do much damage to the Confederate guns.
The shelling continued all day, A big cloud of smoke rose high in the air over Fort Sumter. The smoke was seen by United States Navy ships a few miles outside Charleston Harbor. They had come with the ship bringing food for the men at Sumter. There were soldiers on these ships, but they could not reach the fort to help Major Anderson. Confederate boats blocked the entrance to the harbor, and Confederate guns could destroy any ship that tried to enter. The commander of the naval force, Captain Fox, had hoped to move the soldiers to Sumter in small boats, but the sea was so rough that the small boats could not be used. Fox could only watch and hope for calmer seas.
Confederate shells continued to smash into Sumter throughout the night and into the morning of the second day. The fires at Fort Sumter burned higher, and smoke filled the rooms where soldiers still tried to fire their cannons. About noon, three men arrived at the fort in a small boat. One of them was Lewis Wigfall, a former United States senator from Texas, now a Confederate officer. He asked to see Major Anderson. "I come from General Beauregard," he said. "It is time to put a stop to this, sir. The flames are raging all around you, and you have defended your flag bravely. Will you leave, sir?" Wigfall asked.
Major Anderson was ready to stop fighting. His men had done all that could be expected of them. They had fought well against a much stronger enemy. Anderson said he would surrender if he and his men could leave with honor. Wigfall agreed. He told Anderson to lower his flag and the firing would stop. Down came the United States flag, and up went the white flag of surrender. The battle of Fort Sumter was over. More than 4,000 shells had been fired during the 33 hours of fighting, but no one on either side was killed. One United States soldier, however, was killed the next day when a cannon exploded as Anderson's men prepared to leave the fort.
The news of Anderson's surrender reached Washington late Saturday, April 13th. President Lincoln and his cabinet met the next day and wrote a declaration that the president would announce on Monday. In it, Lincoln said powerful forces had seized control in 7 states of the South. He said these forces were too strong to be stopped by courts or policemen. Lincoln said troops were needed. He requested that the states send him 75,000 soldiers. He said these men would be used to get control of forts and other federal property seized from the Union.
Lincoln knew he had the support of his own party. He also wanted Northern Democrats to give him full support. So, Sunday evening, a Republican congressman visited the top Democrat of the North, Senator Stephen Douglas. The congressman urged Douglas to go to the White House and tell Lincoln that he would do all he could to help put down the rebellion in the South. At first, Douglas refused. He said Lincoln had removed Democrats, friends of his, from government jobs, and had given the jobs to Republicans. Douglas said he didn't like this. "Anyway," he said, Lincoln probably did not want his advice. The congressman, George Ashmun, urged Douglas to forget party politics. He said Lincoln and the country needed the senator's help. Douglas finally agreed to talk with Lincoln. He and Ashmun went immediately to the White House.
Lincoln welcomed his old political opponent. He explained his plans and read to Douglas the declaration he would announce the next day. Douglas said he agreed with every word of it, except, he said, 75,000 soldiers would not be enough. Remembering his problems with Southern extremists, he urged Lincoln to ask for 200,000 men. He told the president, "You do not know the dishonest purposes of those men as well as I do." Lincoln and Douglas talked for 2 hours. Then the senator gave a statement for the newspapers. He said he still opposed the administration on political questions, but, he said, he completely supported Lincoln's efforts to protect the Union. Douglas was to live for only a few more months. He spent this time working for the Union. He traveled through the states of the Northwest, making many speeches. Douglas urged Democrats everywhere to support the Republican government. He told them, "There can be no neutrals in this war, only patriots or traitors."
The North, thousands of men rushed to answer Lincoln's call for troops. Within 2 days, a military group from Boston left for Washington. Other groups formed quickly in northern cities and began training for war. Lincoln received a different answer, however, from the border states between North and South. Virginia's governor said he would not send troops to help the North get control of the South. North Carolina's governor said the request violated the Constitution. He would have no part of it. Tennessee said it would not send one man to help force Southern states back into the Union. But it said it would send 50,000 troops to defend Southern rights. Lincoln got the same answer from the governors of Kentucky, Arkansas, and Missouri. For several days, it seemed that all these states would secede and join the Southern Confederacy.
Lincoln worried most about Virginia, the powerful state just across the Potomac River from Washington. A secession convention already was meeting at the state capital. On April 17th, the convention voted to take Virginia out of the Union. Virginia's vote to secede forced an American Army officer to make a most difficult decision. The officer was Colonel Robert E. Lee, a citizen of Virginia. The Army's top commander, General Winfield Scott, had called Lee to Washington. Scott believed Lee was the best officer in the Army. Lincoln agreed. He asked Lee to take General Scott's job to become the Army chief. Lee was offered the job on the same day that Virginia left the Union.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.